Well, enough of Thatch here, and I don't mean to monopolize your time, so we'll make this one quick and get to the break. But this was kind of a fun research project that I did several years ago. Title is Salinity Impacts the Vigor of Sea Dwarf, Sea Sharp Pass Palum. And in Florida, there's a lot of trend towards going to Sea Sharp Pass Palum as an alternate turf for Bermuda grasses on golf courses. And I'll start this talk by saying that irrigating turf with non-potable water conserves freshwater resources, and I think we all know that. And there's a big trend towards irrigating golf courses and parks and things like that with reclaimed water. There are a number of grasses. Sea dwarf is only one. Pass palums that are now being marketed specifically for that use. And advertising, and this is advertising taken right off the sea dwarf website, suggests that sea dwarf, seashore pass palum, can be irrigated with brackish water with an expectation of high quality. And this is exactly what they say. Safe drinking water may be irrigated with alternative water sources such as effluent or brackish. But the caveat here is that there's an expectation of high quality that's going to go along with that, especially if you're using it for putting greens and other turf on golf courses and other high-end turf grass venues. So we did some research to determine if sea dwarf quality was going to be affected by brackish water. And what we did here is we took containerized sea dwarf, we removed it from a putting green, we planted it in terracotta containers, we flood irrigated it once daily for 50 consecutive days with seven different irrigation sources ranging in salinity from 0.52 to 49.4 decisiemens per meter. And in this research, we had an experimental design, a completely randomized design, with seven treatments, our seven irrigation sources, and six replications. And this is the experiment prior to putting any treatments out. Okay, so the turf looks pretty uniform here. Our treatments consisted of two water sources, tap water from Lee County Utilities, and I live in Lee County, this is Fort Myers, Florida. And then we took ocean water directly out of the Gulf of Mexico at Fort Myers Beach. And so this research had its perks because we'd go to the beach, we'd collect some water, we'd hang out at the beach for a little while, and then we'd go back to the laboratory and irrigate our grass. And Fort Myers Beach is a pretty nice beach, and the water there is pretty good. I mean, as far as ocean water goes, there's not a lot of algae or weeds or anything like that, not any things to really complicate, you know, our research. And so we used tap water and ocean water in themselves as two of the treatments, and then we created five different blends, where we blended five parts tap to one part seawater, four parts tap to one sea, three to one, two to one, and et cetera. So we had seven different irrigation sources. When we looked at what our sources were, our tap water had an electrical conductivity, the EC of the irrigation water, of about 0.52 decisiemens per meter, which is pretty good. This is potable water. You know, we got it out of the tap at the laboratory. It's hooked up to the drinking fountain. Students were drinking it every day, so pretty good quality water. 53 parts per million sodium and an SAR value, a sodium adsorption ratio value, about 2.08. Our first blend, though, our most dilute blend, 5:1, the electrical conductivity jumped up to 10. We had 1,700 parts per million sodium now and an SAR of 20, which I thought was extremely high. 4:1, our SAR went up to 24, and the EC went up to 11, 3:1, EC of 14.5, SAR 26, and so on. Our 1:1, our 50-50 blend, EC of 27, very, very high, 4,200 ppm sodium, SAR value of 32, pretty high. Seawater, SAR value of just about 40. Okay, 49 decisiemens per meter. Now, I thought these values were high. I just actually was consulting on a golf course here recently within the last couple weeks. They were showing me their irrigation test results for their irrigation water for one of their wells. SAR value of 60. Okay, and this is a place where actually where pass palum is being used. All right, so I thought these values were pretty high until I actually go out in the real world, and they're not so bad. So what we did is we applied our irrigation blends, about 250 mils of water for 50 consecutive days. There was free leaching. We didn't try to contain it. It just leached through the pot. We didn't apply any fertilizer to it. These pots had established for about 60 days, you know, and we'd kept them mowed, and everything was treated very uniformly before we actually applied the treatments. But during or after we applied the treatments, we didn't mow the pots. We didn't apply any kind of pesticide. They were kept in full sun, and this was done in March, you know, in Florida. So it wasn't terribly, terribly hot, but it wasn't real cool either. You know, full sun. We kept them from receiving any kind of rainfall. This was kind of like the dry season in Florida, so if we knew it was going to rain, we'd take the pots, we'd move them under the overhang so they wouldn't be exposed to any rainwater. We just wanted them to be exposed to the treatment waters. And several times, actually four times throughout the 50-day period, we evaluated our units for visual quality on a 1 to 9 scale, 1 being the worst quality and 9 being the best. And here's what some of the grasses actually tended to look like here. They're not a whole big difference in the way the grass appears color-wise necessarily, but we'll get to that in a minute. When we looked at 3 days after treatment, our initial treatment, we saw that we had a fairly flat line when we described visual quality in terms of our 1 to 9 scale over the 50-day period, okay? Or actually, this is irrigation, electrical conductivity, not the 50-day period, but this is electrical conductivity in decisiemens per meter. So the further out we get here, the more salt we're applying to the turf. At 10 days, we see the slope begin to move down. At 29 days, we see it become curvilinear. And at 38 days, it's almost a perfect curvilinear line, where our R-squared here is 0.998, and we had significant differences through all these days, you know, through all these quality evaluation dates in terms of quality, okay? But when we got out here towards the end of the study, okay, the differences became very, very pronounced, and it was easy to make the ratings. So when we looked at analyzing our data, we saw that we had significant differences due to the irrigation blends themselves. But when we looked at the influence over time for our four rating dates, we also found that the differences were significant by rating date, and we had an interaction. But the interaction can be explained by the fact that salinity level and the length of exposure to that salinity tended to be important in producing an effect on turf grass quality. So the more salt you put down and the longer the exposure was to that irrigation source, the more of an effect it had on turf quality. When we looked at something more conventional, again, such as clipping yield, what we found is that we had a significant decrease in clippings as our salinity level increased, and we had highly significant differences by our statistical analysis. It's kind of interesting here, though, that we got to our 5-to-1, 4-to-1, and 3-to-1 blends, and there was really no difference in clippings here. Okay, so we had a threshold here. So just by adding some salinity, we decreased our threshold, but until we actually got it up at about our 2-to-1 and 1-to-1 blend, we didn't see a real tapering off of the amount of clippings that were able to be collected in terms of grams per square meter. Okay, so we had a nice threshold effect here. When we looked at some of this data in terms of clipping yields, the electrical conductivity where we would expect to have half the amount of clippings be produced, okay, was 17.4 decisiemens. And that's similar to what was reported for Adelaide, which is a different variety of seashore pass palum, by Dudek and Peacock in 1985. The electrical conductivity of the irrigation water, where we would expect a 25% reduction, was 8 decisiemens, and that was identical to Adelaide, as reported by Lee et al. In 2002. And so what we concluded from this was that the salinity tolerance of Seedorf was very similar to Adelaide, okay? And if you read what Duncan has written in his book, this would be considered moderate salinity tolerance, okay? At least in terms of clipping yield. When we looked at our relative leaf texture, this was one of the most noticeable components, okay, of this experiment, is that we had an almost linear, with an R-squared of 99.99, we had an almost linear decrease in leaf texture, blade thickness, with salinity. So the more salt we put on, the finer textured that turf became. And everybody that I would show this to would be just looking at it going, wow, you know, that's very, very stunning. And it really was, because where we put fresh water on, the blades were big and fat, and where we put salt water on, they got progressively, or actually in a linear response, they got thinner and thinner and thinner. One of the most interesting aspects of this study was in lateral stem production. Because as we began to apply salinity, here's our untreated, okay, you know, we had our tap water here. Now we put some salt water on here, our 5-to-1 blend, the most dilute blend. We got a significant reduction in the number of stolons. And as we got down to our, this is our 5-to-1, 4-to-1, 3-to-1, when we got to 2-to-1 and 1-to-1 in seawater, we had no stolons. Okay? And you can see that in this picture. This is where we irrigated it with seawater. Now, some people will tell you you can irrigate past Palom with seawater and have good results. I tend to disagree with that. Okay? Because when we put seawater on this grass, you could watch it fry. It only took about an hour. But 1-to-1, you know, it's still got pretty good color, but there's not one stolon hanging over the edge of the pot after 50 days. And here's our tap water, and we've got a lot of stolons hanging over the edge here. Okay. When we looked at the length of the stolons that were hanging over the edges of the pots, we saw the same kind of effect, where we had very, very few stolons. They were tended to be smaller and shorter. Okay, so not only were there fewer of them, but they were smaller and they were shorter. So in effect, what happened here, and you can clearly see this in this picture, here's our seawater, 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 1-to-1, not a stolon. Here we got a few stolons, they're pretty short. Here's our 5-to-1, a lot more stolons. Here's the tap water, can't see it real good, but there's all kinds of stolons and a lot of plant material here. So salinity changed the growth habit of this grass. Now if you were to irrigate it back with fresh water again, would the stolons come back? Probably. So it's not a permanent change, but I think that any time you can do something culturally and change the growth habit of your grass, you know, to me that's pretty cool. When we looked at salination of the soil, we saw a linear increase in EC. This was using a 1-to-1 where you had, you know, like 5 mils of water and 5 grams of soil, okay? Percent moisture in the plant tissue decreased. And another very interesting aspect, and we heard about temperatures on turf a little bit earlier today, when we looked at canopy temperatures of these grasses, and we did this on at least here 6 different occasions, February through March, okay, and we found significant differences, we have an almost linear increase in canopy temperatures with salinity. So as that turf grew less in response to salinity, became finer textured and had less lateral growth, the canopy temperatures became higher and higher and higher. And here's our ambient temperatures, and we actually had canopy temperatures up above 110 degrees, which is, you know, not unusual. But again, now this is in February and March in Florida, so it's not during our real hot season. And so not only were some of the growth characteristics affected by salinity, but some of the physiology of the plant was likely affected by it as well. So in conclusion, the salinity level and length of exposure were important in producing an effect on turf quality. And again, I say salinity changed the growth habit of that turf. It became a non-stoloniferous grass in response to applying enough salt to it. And salinity also induced changes in several plant characteristics that collectively contribute to quality. Okay, the differences in quality were really nominal, but they were there. Okay. And now if you were to put traffic and other things that go with turf on, you know, golf courses and sports field, no telling exactly what kind of a situation you would have. But the main conclusion here is that we felt like irrigating with water having a lower electrical conductivity resulted in more vigorous seed dwarf. Okay? And one of the major points of this paper, and one of the reasons this research was done, is that I do a lot of consulting and people say to me, well, we can use past Palom and we can throw the crappiest water on it that we have and everything's going to be fine. And I'm going, wait a minute, it's still a plant and it's going to be infected and impacted by salinity, like all plants are. Okay? So irrigating with water, having a lower EC, less salt, less salty water, resulted in more vigorous seed dwarf. And I'll end this talk by saying that we all have better uses for salty water than, you know, worrying about putting it on seashore past Palom. Okay, so thank you for listening to me, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Any questions for William?
Yes.
Just curious, you know, you say that adding salt makes the seed dwarf get finer leaves and no stolons. What's it like if you mow it at cutting green height? Have you basically created a seed four velvet bed?
Well, if you were to put enough salt on it, at least in theory, that would be possible. But my experience is that when you're irrigating it with enough salt to do something like that, the traffic has other impacts on it. And if it didn't receive any traffic or any play, you know, quite possibly it could do that. But I've never actually observed that personally, because I think there are other effects that, you know, impact it as well out there. Great question, though. Yes?
Going back to your opening slide where you commented about the advertising on that, particularly regarding brackish water, how would you change that wording now that you know what the experiment showed you?
Well, I would tend to change it by saying that this grass is probably more receptive to alternative water sources, and I would leave it at that. Because to say that it's going to do well under conditions of brackish water is probably not true. And I'm a pretty honest guy, and I would have a hard time looking somebody in the face and telling them, yeah, if you put this grass down, you can irrigate it with seawater and you're going to be just fine. I mean, I would never say that to somebody. I think that I have seen it used in areas. I have a consulting client at Key West Golf Club. That's a tidal golf course. The tide comes in, the bunkers and part of the fairways fill up with water, seawater. Tide goes out, they drain away. The Bermuda grass that's there is 419, doesn't do well. We've put some Aloha and a couple other past palms down in there. It seems to do pretty good. But now, is it really good quality turf? No, it's surviving. And so, again, I would change that. I would change that opening statement to say is probably more receptive to alternative waters. And I wouldn't even mention brackish water. And again, one of the reasons that I did this particular research was to prove a point to several people that I know in South Florida who are saying, well, yeah, well, we can just throw this grass down, we can irrigate it with salt water, everything's going to be fine. And I'm going, no, not everything's going to be fine. Because even if the turf tolerates it, it's the soil that becomes deteriorated. And once the soil deteriorates because of all the sodium and other materials that, you know, contribute to the defocculation of that soil and hinder its drainage and things like that, grass just doesn't do well, no matter what kind of grass you got. Did I answer your question?
What kind of soil was in
a
small clay plot?
That was a DOT 220 sand. So it was a straight sand, not amended with any kind of organic matter.
I just wanted to interject that we are now on our break. However, I think this would be a good opportunity to ask, since William's up here, if you have any more questions for him, ask him. And then if any of our earlier speakers are here and you have questions for them, now would be a good time for that too. So.
On your thatch studies, you had ocean dwarf and tip dwarf, and it went through Wiley Mill. Do you think any of the results that you saw was a function of not exposure, but maybe ultimately cell size between the ocean dwarf and the tip dwarf, or how would it affect the thatch decomposition rates?
Well, grinding it with the Wiley Mill ultimately increased the rate of mineralization, there's no question. Whether or not there was a difference in those two grasses as a result of grinding is an excellent question. I'm not sure I have an answer for that. I don't know. But that'd be a great experiment to try. But the one thing that we did, and I've done this several times, is that every time we put TIF Dwarf and TIF Eagle together, there was a difference in the rate of decay. And in the paper that I wrote, I published it in Crop Science a couple years ago. You know, we attributed it to maybe the fact that the TIF Eagle has a shorter stolons and may have more lignin in it, you know. But I actually tried to measure lignin, you know, in these grasses and didn't really find any significant difference. I don't know. Great questions. And that's why I'd really like to see a graduate student at this point try to pick this research up and run with it, because I think we're at the cusp maybe of beginning to unlock some of the things that you might need to know and questions you might need to answer to really figure out how to get thatch decay. Because like I said, if you go back and look, and I actually done research on this. I'm writing part of the paper on organic matter dynamics with rock for the new monograph, And I looked specifically at thatch history, going back in the USGA journals and as far back as I could get, any as far back as 1926, they're talking about thatch. It's a fact it's resilient to water, and it has an effect on putting green surfaces, and it doesn't decay well, and we're looking for methods to control it. And that continues to today, you know. Bob?
The one paper that you mentioned about Jack Palm's work, that graduate student gives a talk, he's on 197-5, and we're using lignin-based axial, more resistant material, which opens it up, and then it's set to pretty good results. The 197.
Is that a poster he's doing? Or is it an oral talk? I mean, I talked to Jack and Sudeep is the graduate student. Yeah, and I talked to them back at the.
I think there is tomorrow sometime.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to be gone. I'm going to be in San Diego tomorrow, but I did talk to them briefly about it, and I said, you know, I think, and I actually talked to Paul Raymer too, and well, Bob, this goes for you too. I think, you know, this is something that, you know, should be taken up, and if the University of Georgia could do it, I mean, I think that'd be great, and I'm certainly willing to contribute what I can to it. Yeah, because he was showing me some of his research data, and it looks impressive. And you know, I would think if you were to, you know, what I would do now, aside from making the C14 thatch, which would be papers in itself, is I would put cellulase in, and I'd wait to get to you know, where the slow pool showed up, and then I'd start adding the other material and see if you can get a double dip on that. You know what I'm talking about? Where you'd start to see that decay. I think that'd be pretty neat.
Is there a different use in Spearman-Rank coefficients for analysis of variance versus regression? I don't know how Spearman-Rank shows homogeneity. Can you explain that?
I'm not sure I can explain that. I'm not a biometrician. These were things spit out by the computer. And basically, what I've read about it is that their independence of residuals are important. Normal distribution is important. And linearity is also important. And if you can have passing grades, if you will, on those three parameters, the model is generally going to be considered to be reliable and valid. Beyond that, I'm not enough of a statistician to go into that. But again, an excellent question.
Thinking about the difference between the tip fork and the tip eagle mineralization and thinking more from a compositional basis, did you ensure that from a prior history standpoint as far as overseeding that been done on both of those areas, was that similar and consistent?
Yeah, it was, because these were, and I failed to say that during the course of the study, these were actually on two greens that I personally constructed that were built at the same time with the same materials by the same contractor and grassed on the same day. I grassed them personally. The only thing that was different was it was Tiff Eagle versus Tiff Dwarf. And that was done at Edison State College back in 2003. So those greens were about 5 years old, 6 years old at that time. So there was no other no other grasses were involved in that. And that's why I felt comfortable doing that. And that's one of the reasons I built those greens, is I wanted to be able to use that for thatch research. Other questions? Thank you very much for listening to me this morning.